Welcome to A Mathematical Basis for Reality.
Chris, I think you should tell them that Physical Truth is a book on mathematics and philosophy, and that it's a good story.
Hi, I just wanted to make some comments here. This has been fairly deep, and we're up to chapter 15 now. We're quite a long ways into our episodes, and I have to appreciate those who have really hung in there. There are those who have actually gone through this entire podcast and hung in there, and there is a lot of math with this. This is not easy stuff, and there are like consequences and stuff like that regarding philosophy, but the mathematics is on very solid footing. So for those of you who have actually lasted all the way through this, I think you deserve a huge congratulations. And we're now coming up near to the end. And here I want to basically talk about consequences and how we're going to actually reach an end to wrap this up so that we can take what we've learned regarding the universe, regarding galaxies, and how do we apply that to truth, and how do we apply that to something that we can apply in our daily lives. This particular episode regards chapter 15. Is called Entropy Reversal at Galactic Centers. Before I talk about something like entropy reversal, first off, entropy does increase. We look at it in various ways. And what the heck do we mean by entropy anyway? Entropy is kind of like where we all start off as being useful, and then we end up not being so useful later on. I'm talking about galaxies. If we look at the statements that I've made, that the universe is infinite and eternal, if we now have to deal with eternity, eternity has got a bit of a problem to it because things wind down eventually. Stuff becomes more useless or more difficult to turn into something that is useful or make something useful out of it. And this is known as something like, this is called entropy. If a good example is strike a match. If you strike a match, happens to consist of some sulfur, I think some phosphorus, at the end of a strike anywhere match with a wooden stick on it, and you strike the match and a flame erupts and you now have a lit match which will burn through the wooden stem of the match, the matchstick. Once the match has been burned through the matchstick, no matter how often you try and strike that match, you're never going to get it to light again. This is the idea of entropy, that things are arranged chemically in a certain order. And sometimes it's looked at in terms of order and disorder. And then once all the molecules have formed in the chemical reactions, the flame has been there, the light and heat has been all dispersed, is now termed as being completely or very much more disordered afterwards. So that this disorder is usually associated with entropy. And this disorder always increases in the universe. Things go from being ordered to disordered. Our lives go from being ordered to disordered. And I think we can all follow that concept. So, if the universe is eternal, how come we're still around? Why hasn't the universe died out? I'll talk about the anthropomorphic answer to this, that we just happen to be alive at a time when it's possible for us to be alive, and the universe will then die out and, you know, had a beginning and so forth. We just happen to be here, and therefore that's why we're here. I don't buy that. I don't buy that as a reason or a cause to anything, although it's been promoted. I think, who was it? Hoyle. Yes, if I remember reading Hoyle talking about the anthropomorphic, this anthropomorphic theory. That we just happen to be here at this time because this is the only time we can be here. Silly argument, really. So I want to take a look at this rather than from a subjective point of view of where we are and how do we experience what we are in, to a more objective view. Let's take a large-scale view of the universe. It don't matter about, you know, the fact that we just happen to be here talking about a universe. The fact is, the universe winds down. The universe eventually has to wind down. All the stars have to burn out eventually because of this law of entropy, because everything winds down and there's no way for it to get back together again, except for one little place that I have managed to find in the universe, and that little place is in very fast, oh, not in, it's on the surface of very fast spinning black holes. We usually find these things at the center of galaxies. And this now becomes very exciting because we can apply this now in a basis for how we look at our place in the universe, our overall, if you like, philosophical view, who we are and what is our place. Also, just found out yesterday, a very good friend of mine, probably my, well, he is, he's my best friend, is on dialysis and has about 5 years left to live. He's a Mountie, and I've known him since the year 2000. We met each other. We're about as opposite ends of the table you could possibly imagine. He's very good at computers, wrote a lot of code, down in times when code was actually being cut, real code was being cut. Grew up in Fort Chip, knows a lot of Cree, played hockey with those guys. Is an outstanding human being, an outstanding Mountie, and one of the nicest and kindest men you could ever meet. And we're looking at this time of the end because eventually his kidneys will go, and he may get a replacement so that he may last a long time. But he is now starting to look at the end, and this also brings me to the point of looking at the end. And in the overall view of the universe that we are coming to, is there such a thing as a renewal of ourselves and our consciousness? Is there such a thing as going on? And even more important, what is it that we have done? Have we made any effect in our lives on anything that is around us? Or, you know, does it just end and there's, you know, that didn't seem to be amount to anything? And our species may possibly be no more. And it may be that the universe will continue on as though we had never existed in the first place. Or does it make a difference? Does it make a difference that we are here, that we're kind, and we did good things for other people? Does that make a difference? Okay, we're... Let's see, we tune into the subject of cosmology. We have astronomy, which is all sorts of elements in the periodic table and stellar atmospheres and so forth. We also have a classification, or a subject area known as cosmology, the study of the large-scale universe, or large-scale structure of the universe. And within this, the periodic table is incredibly simple. There's right now this meme going around, which is the big joke, which has always been a big joke. It's a very old joke, in which there are only three elements in the entire periodic table for cosmologists. One is hydrogen, of course. Everything's made of hydrogen pretty well. There's a bit of helium around, I guess, we have to look at, and everything else is just known as heavy metals. Heavy metals are called the Z classification of material. There's hydrogen, helium, and Z, or heavy metals, and that's all there is to the universe. As we look at it, and things, stars burn as hydrogen, which causes a burn for a while, as a fusion basically an ongoing fusion furnace of hydrogen in the cores of most stars, of all what we call main sequence stars. This produces a number of things, carbon, nitrogen, but mostly helium. And when the amount of helium is large enough, when the amount of helium is concentrated enough, and enough of the hydrogen has burned out, then the hydrogen burn extinguishes, the star collapses on itself, temperature and pressure go up, and you end up with a helium bomb. A helium bomb is a triple alpha process, and this ignites, and there are fluctuations as this thing expands, because helium explosion is much more powerful than the hydrogen explosion, or let's say energy efficient is the best way to put it. It's more powerful. I think it's order 12 orders of magnitude more than the hydrogen. And as a result, the star becomes much larger. This is where the red giants are formed. The red giants are basically burning in the triple alpha process using a helium bomb in the center of it. And they burn for a while, but not nearly as long as the main sequence star, when it was a main sequence star. And so this is your expanded red giant. Oh, please excuse me. So our sun, we believe in about another 5 billion years, or maybe tomorrow, we don't really know, will snuff out, and then the helium burn will ignite, and the sun will end up expanding to a region of about the asteroid belt, and our Earth will be engulfed in the center of this star and probably completely evaporate and be no more. Now, after the helium burns out, again, there's nothing to prevent the self-gravitational attraction of the particles that make up the star, and everything's going to collapse back in on itself. And there's nothing to stop it, of course, with the exception of the actual sort of atomic structure of the atoms that form. And basically what happens, it forms a white dwarf. And we can think of, and I'm using an analogy here, so I'm stretching it. So please forgive me for this. Basically, the sun will end up as a white dwarf because of its mass. We're pretty sure about this. A lot of stuff that we've examined regarding the masses of stars and how they end up. And how a star ends up depends on its mass. So a star of one solar mass, basically the mass of the sun, will end up as a white dwarf. And a white dwarf, everything that is, including the Earth, our bodies, everything, if they haven't been ejected, basically is material in a nova, then, or also converted into electromagnetic radiation, commonly known as light and heat, will then collapse into sort of a structure of, let's say, a nucleus of some form in the middle with this massive cloud of electrons around the outside of it. And that's a white dwarf. And that'll go on for a very, very long time, but even that will eventually decay. If the sun was bigger, past the Chandrasekhar limit, don't know offhand what the Chandrasekhar limit is. Chandrasekhar won the Nobel Prize for it, by the way, and then became the editor of APJ, the Astrophysical Journal, for a while. It was interesting. Interesting story there. Werner told me that story. It was that prior to Chandrasekhar was a chap by the name... Eddington. Very famous. Astronomer of the early 1900s. And Chandrasekhar had his work that he was trying to put forward, and Chandrasekhar was ludicrously humiliated and ridiculed by Eddington. Eddington really had it out for him, went out of his way to hurt Chandrasekhar and ridicule him enormously. And then, of course, Chandrasekhar won the Nobel Prize and took over Eddington's job. So one of the things we see is what goes around comes around. And it was really, I think, from the work of Chandrasekhar that put the Astrophysical Journal on the footing that it had. And those who are left behind after Dr. Chandrasekhar have some very, very large shoes to fill. that is that sort of story. We see a lot of stories about, you know, what goes around comes around. Okay, so we now have that a star, let's say, has more mass than the Chandrasekhar limit and is below 6.4 solar masses. 6.4 solar masses of a star mass is now going to become very important, but somewhere below that is the Chandrasekhar limit. And this star would end up becoming what's known as a pulsar or a neutron star. That was discovered by Dr. Burrell. It's Joss Bell. Jocelyn Bell Burrell. She wishes to go by the name of Dr. Bell Burrell. And I met Joss up in Edmonton at one time. We were doing a talk on radio astronomy. Well, I was doing a talk on radio astronomy, and she was doing a talk on this planet bazaar thing that was supposed to show up and so forth. And she was showing that this group that thought that this new planet was going to show up and so forth was complete nonsense. It was an excellent talk. Nevertheless, that would be a neutron star, which is sort of this great big, I personally believe, Hyperion, this massive thing is spinning like a banshee. It's got huge magnetic fields on it, and we can see it because it pulses very rapidly, many times a second. Well, it's spinning many times a second, and as it's spinning, it spins like a top, precesses like mad, and this top spins. I mean, we're thinking, something fairly massive, about the size of a planet, spinning like crazy, and it's, precessing. When the top slows down, you see it wobble. And so it's wobbling while it's slowing down, and the top's is emitting a beam of magnetic field, which crosses towards the Earth at certain times, many times a second, and it picks up these beeps, which at first were thought to be little green men, but it was not. The person who thought they were little green men was the man who ended up winning the Nobel Prize at the end. So there's huge controversy at that, because it was really Dr. Bell Burrell who found it and knew exactly what it was, these were pulsars. So she is credited with finding out that pulsars exist, world's expert, of course, on their structure, and we're waiting still for what goes around comes around on that particular story. Nevertheless, that's what we would end up as, some sort of extremely hard nucleus, we want to call it, or neutron star, such that if an atom fell onto the surface of it, the atom would be completely squished and spread out like a coat of paint on the surface of the entire neutron star, spinning like a banshee. If a star has more mass than 6.4 solar masses, there even the forces that would keep it up, which is sometimes known as the strong nuclear force. We believe it has very, very much a connection with the strong nuclear force and what keeps a neutron star from collapsing further. But the gravity would be so strong, by that I mean the gravitational fields would be so strong, if the star has more mass or more density, which is really what makes it work, then the star itself would collapse completely. And there would be then formed what we know as a black hole. A black hole is kind of a lot like anything. It's really just a mathematical position. It's a spot. It's a location. It's a set of locations, all right? And these locations are in the form of a sphere around wherever this star went. And once this sphere, which is just a location, it's not made of anything, and this particular location or sphere around the area wherever the star went or collapsed into, known as a singularity, but this location is a place where the escape velocity, the escape velocity is equal to the speed of light, and therefore nothing can escape. So if we talk about, we can spend a long time on escape velocities, we're going to get lost on that, but all right, you can't get away from it. Light cannot escape from it, hence it's known as a black hole. And once something has crossed this particular, known as an event horizon, this location is known as an event horizon, also called the Schwarzschild radius from the center of where this imagined singularity is, but we don't know if there is a singularity or not. Once something crosses this event horizon, it leaves our consideration forever. That's the way that Dr. Israel described it. And he puts teeth on it. He says, okay, draws a circle on the whiteboard and puts teeth on the interior of this circle, on the circumference of the circle, puts teeth pointing in. And says, these are teeth. Once something crosses the event horizon, it leaves our consideration forever because nothing can escape from a black hole. We cannot determine anything that has gone inside it. We're not going to say it doesn't exist. We're not going to say it does exist. We're not going to say anything about it because it leaves our consideration forever. We don't consider anything on the interior of a black hole. If anyone talks to you about what's going on, about the inside of a black hole, you are allowed to ignore everything that they are saying. Nothing comes out of a black hole. We have no idea what goes on in a black hole. When something crosses the interior of a black hole, leaves our consideration. We don't consider it. We ignore it. It is not considered. What we do consider is if we are very intelligent, and I'm quoting Dr. Israel here, if we're very, very intelligent, we can calculate what is going on and talk about places that are very near the surface of this black hole. And if we are incredibly intelligent and we're real smart and do an awful lot of work through a lot of paper and go through a lot of pencil and paper and do the calculations, we can actually find out what is going on the surface of a black hole. And it is the surface of this black hole that I think is very important, because here we get to see something that is quite remarkable. And it is something that is happening in a way with the interaction between the material that crosses this horizon, the event horizon, this surface, that leaves our consideration forever, and the effect that this material has on the surface of the black hole and the overall black hole itself. And it creates, if you like, a significant amount of more curvature. And this becomes really important if the black hole is spinning, because as material falls in, the angular momentum has to be conserved. In other words, as material is falling in, the black hole continues to spin faster and faster. So black holes, we would say, usually, if they've been around for a while and had material fall into them for a while, the black hole will be spinning very quickly. But there is a limit to how fast this black hole can spin. The black hole cannot spin faster than having the equator move at the speed of light. So if the black hole is spinning so fast that the equator of the black hole is moving at the speed of light, then it cannot spin any faster. But if it can't spin any faster and material falls in and there is angular momentum, how can it be possible? Does the material just bounce off? Or is the material loaded in and we now have more angular momentum that is possible? And does the black hole spin faster than the speed of light? No, it doesn't. It's got to do some stuff. And it's got to do some stuff by following the dictates of the general theory of relativity. So, we have a very fast spinning black hole. We can't add more stuff to it, and yet we do add stuff to it. And there's consequence to that. And I'm now going to relate that in some way to
passing beyond to things dying, including ourselves, and what happens. And there is a clue here, a very interesting clue in what happens at the spinning of very fast black holes, our lives coming to a close, and what we have done in our lives, and the universe and the fate of the universe itself.
This is Chapter 15, Entropy Reversal at Galactic Centers. This is where we take a look at the fact that galaxies should eventually die because all the material that is using in making stars would be used up, and the resultant heavy metals that would be produced would not be able to be used to create new stars. What we're seeing here is that there is what appears to be, from a mathematical derivation of at the surface of very fast spinning black holes, that indeed new material is then produced, and these are in the galactic jets. The galactic jets are primarily 85% hydrogen, about 15% helium, and they are emitted very close to the speed of light, perpendicular to the plane of the galaxy. And it appears that these may possibly come from very fast spinning black holes, which we know are identified at the center of galaxies. So we'll consider the thermodynamic equation. We look at the thermodynamic equation of a spinning black hole with charge. And this comes from Brandon Carter, Stephen Hawking, and James Bardeen. So the formula here is that dm is equal to kappa dA over 8 pi plus omega dj plus vdq. Now to explain this, dm, meaning the change in mass of the black hole itself, is equal to the change in area times this ratio of kappa over 8 pi plus, and this is the angular momentum term, which is omega dj, where j is the angular momentum, plus vdq. Most people know that that's the energy contained with change in basically electric potential and charge. So here, m is the mass, kappa relates to temperature, a is the surface area, omega is the angular velocity, j is the angular momentum, v is the electrostatic potential, and q is the charge. Each of the terms, because these are basically one term on the left and three terms on the right, each of the terms are forms of energy, all energy. The mass energy is the total energy equals the heat energy plus the energy of angular momentum plus the electrical energy. However, to make all the units agree, we add c squared to the left-hand side to make c squared dm. Obviously, mc squared is energy, so c squared dm is equal to, again, kappa over 8 pi times dA plus omega dj plus vdq. Now, the heat term, or the heat energy term, which is kappa over 8 pi times dA, can be thought of as the temperature of the black hole times the surface heat capacity times the area, or kappa over dA, and sorry, kappa over 8 pi times dA, change in area, is equal to, we'll make up a term called capital C sub A, which is the surface heat capacity times the temperature times dA, change in area. Looking at angular momentum term, we have omega dj, because it's a sphere, is equal to v over r times r, r's will cancel, times vdm, which is angular momentum, where v is equal to the tangential velocity of the black hole at its equator, and we end up with omega dj is equal to v squared dm. Okay, velocity squared times mass comes out as energy. This is where J, angular momentum, is equal to R cross Vm, and V is the tangential velocity of the black hole as its equator, which I had said. So let us say that the black hole is spinning, but electrostatically neutral. I've done that just to simplify the math. And if there is electrostatic potential and so forth, it will just make what I'm saying even worse, or you know, it will improve my position in what I'm saying. So rewriting the whole thing. On the left-hand side, we then have 1 over the surface heat capacitance times dm by dA times bracket c squared minus v squared, which is an important factor. C squared minus v squared is equal to the temperature. So if it's C squared minus V squared is equal to the temperature, if V, the velocity of the black hole, velocity, the equatorial velocity, the velocity of the equator of the black hole, squared, becomes C squared, then C squared would be minus C squared, so the temperature would equal zero. So here we see that as V approaches C, the temperature of the black hole decreases. So the faster it's spinning, the colder it gets. C, the temperature of the black hole decreases. V equals C, the temperature of the black hole is at absolute zero. So this ought to bring up a few red flags. At first, it may seem that certain inviolable laws of physics have been broken, which is true. But that is not really important. Let's examine this step by step. Let us say there is a black hole and stuff falls into it at some angle, increasing its spin. Sooner or later, it's spinning so fast that the equator is moving at the speed of light. Please remember that a black hole is not a material object. It is a region where the measure of the escape velocity is the speed of light from a central point or singularity. We cannot measure, detect, or discuss anything within this radius. However, we can discuss what happens at the surface of a black hole. The surface is made up of a measure, and we shall denote the clocks and rulers involved in that measure as space-time. It is convenient to consider space-time as having certain properties similar to a fluid, which has in itself a natural speed of interaction, that is, the speed of light, and a Young's modulus as a result of the stresses and strains of a gravitational field. It also has stresses and strains from an electric and magnetic field. However, we will restrict our discussion to gravitational fields. This set of measures is moving from the spin of the black hole as frame dragging in order to conserve angular momentum. Once the surface of a black hole at its equator has reached the speed of light, it cannot spin any faster. An important property of space-time is that it cannot move faster than the speed of light. It cannot even appear or be measured to move faster than the speed of light. Furthermore, there are circumstances in which the space-time continuum is under tension, strain, and shear, in order to compress or dilate clocks and rulers, in order to maintain this important dictum. We ask that the reader consider that space-time is a medium which can transport electromagnetic radiation as disturbances moving at the speed of light within it. It can also carry gravitational influences in a similar way. However, gravitational influences involve tidal effects as well as stresses and strains along the field lines. Gravitational influences also involve shears in the off-diagonals of both the Einstein and stress-energy tensors. These stresses and strains and shears are often denoted as forces between bodies and are described in the stress-energy tensor. The alteration of the corresponding Einstein tensor from having zero-valued components is what I have come to call curvature, in that it deviates from what is understood as flat space-time. This curvature can also be linked to terms of acceleration or caused by acceleration. That's kind of a mouthful there, but we'll continue. Once a black hole is spinning so fast that its equator is moving at the speed of light, it has no further degrees of freedom. It is at absolute zero. The surface of the black hole is not a material object. It can be thought of as a set of equipotential lines which are capable of moving at speeds up to and including the speed of light. They can also be wound as to abut against the thermodynamic limit of absolute zero. We present a derivation of the Einstein tensor describing sets of equipotential lines on the surface of a black hole. They end up being just lines of latitude and longitude, okay, to determine where we are. If you seen a globe of the Earth with lines of latitude and longitude, ends up with the same thing. We're putting a coordinate system on the surface of the black hole. We then present the consequent measures of these equipotential lines to a black hole whose equator is moving at the speed of light, and follow by throwing a brick into it and mathematically predict certain results which can be verified through observation. Techniques for mathematically deriving the Einstein field equations can be found in the literature. What we present here is a derivation and explanation of the Einstein tensor on the spherical surface of a black hole. It may be that those in the field of observational astronomy may be unfamiliar with or have not seen the usefulness and ease with which a tensor can work in simple geometries. Let us begin with the basic principles and develop step by step the geometry of a curved manifold in a four-dimensional Minkowski space. Consider the surface of a stationary, non-spinning black hole, that is, the event horizon, as a spherical manifold. This manifold has a constant curvature of capital K. Let's also consider this manifold as a radius of rho in a two-dimensional surface described by the angles theta and phi. Okay, now the angle theta is going to be like normal polar coordinates. Phi will be the angle from the z-axis down. Consider the application of Minkowski space. Now, Minkowski space, we all know, is described by ICT, comma x, comma y, comma z in Cartesian coordinates, which is equal to x sub mu. X is a four vector, where ICT is equal to ICT. X is equal to r sub s cos theta sine theta. Y is equal to r sub s sine theta sine phi. And did I say sine theta? I didn't. Okay. ICT equals ICT. X equals r sub s cos theta sine phi. Y equals r sub s sine theta sine phi. Z equals r sub s cos phi. If gamma is the Lorentz transformation of this manifold as a result of the spinning of the black hole, and ds is considered as the measure between events, then the metric would be ds squared equals cdt squared over gamma squared minus d r sub s squared minus gamma squared r sub s squared sine squared theta d theta squared minus r sub s squared cos squared phi d phi squared. Obviously. Now, the manifold determined by the surface of the black hole is a projection of a four-dimensional Minkowski space onto a spherical surface. So we consider the parametric equations of some function, f, which is a function of t r sub s theta phi, which is bounded by the dictates of the Lorentz transformations. Notice that the function f is a vector. It's actually, in this case, a four-vector. Where t will be considered constant, and r sub s is a Schwarzschild radius, which will also be considered a constant. So we're considering time as a constant, and r sub s as a constant. It's non-spinning. In this way, the four-dimensional Minkowski space is collapsed and projected onto the surface of a sphere, which is really a two-dimensional space. The angle brackets below denote the dot product of the vectors produced by the indicated partial differentiations. We're using the parametrization of the sphere of radius r sub s, which is a Schwarzschild radius, of course, centered on the origin as f, different theta this time, I'm bad, I should make it now, okay, f of theta comma phi is equal to bracket, and this is a vector, bracket t comma r sub s sine theta sine phi comma r sub s sine theta sine phi comma r sub s cos theta. And of course t and r sub s is considered as a constant. So we're going to spin it, so let's rake, so we're going to spin it. So what we'll do here is we'll make, yeah, we'll make, t can be varied, but r is now going to be constant, so to make the sphere. So g mu nu, little g mu nu, is called the metric tensor, and it describes the geometry of the local region of spacetime. The components of the metric tensor are g00 is equal to the dot product, obviously, of df by dt and df by dt. G01 is equal to df by dt, df by d theta. G02 is equal to df by dt, df by d phi. G10 is equal to df by d theta, df by dt. G11 would be df by d theta, df by d theta. G12 is df by d theta, df by d phi. G20, I think you're getting the hang of this, all the way up to G22, which is, of course, df by d phi, df by d phi. Now, my mistake is, of course, that it's a three-vector, not a two-vector. It's a three-vector because we're allowing time to vary. And we're going from, the indexes go from 0 up to 2, which is, of course, three indexes. This is actually three vectors. are what we're ending up with. The matrix in this form is equal to capital G mu nu, which is equal to, goes from G00, G01, G02 in the first row, and the last row, second row will be G10, G11, G12, where the G's are lowercase G's. And the last one is G20, G21, G22, which is the last one, which now describes the Einstein tensor for this three-vector with a constant R on a two-dimensional surface of the black hole. Thank you for hanging in there to follow this. So we now have a tensor equation which describes the geometry of the surface of the sphere. If we wish to draw curves or examine various lines and paths on the surface of this sphere, we can create a function, theta phi, for example, then substitute an equation, 15.3, wherever that was, to obtain a curve resulting from f, etc., where r sub s is a constant. We can derive values then required from g mu nu, since g mu nu equals 8 pi t mu nu. We get the tension, shears, stresses, and so forth on the surface of a black hole, and we obtain the complete values of stresses, strains, and shears on the surface of the black hole. Thank you. We've got it. Thank you. That was a difficult part. Now we get to the easy part. It now becomes a lot easier. So if we draw a sphere with lines of latitude and longitude, we can outline or emphasize some lines of longitude from the poles to the equator, which represent longitudinal lines of equal potential. Now, it may be helpful to go through the logistics of drawing such an equipotential lines, recalling ancient technologies of mathematics, which preceded the use of algebra, and was restricted to using only compass and straight edge without numbers and without coordinate system. The construction of various curves and the ability to do things such as bisect angles, construct parallel lines, and so on, we may entertain the idea that solutions to mathematical problems during those times relied on the ability to successfully complete geometrical constructions. The construction of a line on the surface of a sphere, which indicates the path of a photon, no, it doesn't. This part, I've had to change this part, and this is an old version of this. Newer one is actually on there. What we're doing is we're drawing lines, and they must maintain what's known as the metric. In other words, these lines, on these lines, the speed of light will be measured as a constant in all reference frames. So the Einstein equations then show the interactions between physical and material interactions as a result of local geometries. If we are to draw an equipotential line from the pole of a non-spinning black hole to the equator, simply draw the lines of longitude. So no photon or light can escape from the surface of a black hole. And we draw equipotential lines. These are lines of gravitational potential, which could serve the metric, and is therefore, on the spherical surface, a line of longitude running from pole to equator. We set r sub s to unity, so we can just draw the thing. We then set phi to some value of phi naught, and keep it constant while increase the value of... we set theta to some value of theta naught and then keep the constant while increasing the value of phi. So what we're doing is going tangentially around the black hole as it is spinning, and we're going to just traverse this particular line and trace it from the pole down, and that increases the value of phi from 0 to 2 pi. That line describes the top equipotential line. On the bottom half, we again keep theta as theta naught and decrease the value of phi from pi to pi by 2. We then have a set of values of phi while theta and r sub s are constant. We take these sets of values and substitute them back into the equation, which is the metric, and from there, should one wish, the elements of the Einstein tensor be determined and the resultant stresses and so on, found along the paths of equipotential lines so described. The resultant curvature is some constant kappa, as previously stated. This is the technique that was used to draw figures we have here, like figure 15.1, is just the poles and so forth, outlines of a stationary, non-spinning black hole. Long story short, is lines of latitude and longitude on a globe. Let us now see what these longitudinal equipotential lines look like if the black hole was spinning. As we traverse in the local reference frame on the surface of the black hole, following the equipotential lines of the pole to the equator, we would rotate as move towards the equator. If some point, P,
P, over which we traverse, was moving with tangential velocity V sub T, then it would have moved through some angle theta sub T by the time we traversed from the pole to the point under consideration. Furthermore, local clocks and rulers at the point P have altered from the clocks and rulers in an inertial spacetime by the Lorentz factor of gamma equal to 1 over square root of 1 minus V sub T squared, which is relative to the speed of light, where V sub T, right here it is, in terms of the speed of light and unitless. Therefore, if the tangential speed of the surface of the sphere is dependent on the latitude and time is dependent on the Lorentz factor, then the measure of theta in the local reference frame of the surface of the black hole is V sub T equals V sub E sine phi. Gamma is equal to 1 over the square root of 1 minus V sub T squared, and theta is equal to gamma V sub T, where V sub E is the tangential velocity of the surface of the black hole at the equator. So we're keeping this constant. We're just dealing with how fast is this thing spinning at the equator, and then back and through all the formulas from there. We show various equipotential lines of longitude of black holes spinning with different speeds in 15.2. So we'll move to 15.2. So we start off with a stationary one in which the lines are all nice and straight, just looking like normal lines of latitude and longitude. B, at half the speed of light, we begin to see that these longitudinal lines are starting to bend at the point of the equator. So straight at the poles, and then it comes down and bends along the line of the equator, slightly, you know, deviating from the what looks like a straight line. And then at 0.9, it's bending quite a bit, so that as the black hole spins, these lines of equipotential, these longitudinal lines going from pole to pole, then come down to the equator. But at the equator, they're quite bent. They're quite dragged along at the equator, and then they straighten out and go back to the pole again. So they're symmetrical, top and bottom. And then when the black hole is moving at the speed of light, we see that the line of longitude becomes infinite. It becomes infinitely long to the equator. And the same thing for the southern pole, if we think of it as the southern pole, comes up and also in the same way bends, in the same direction, and it is infinitely long. So the black hole is spinning with an equator moving at the speed of light, and the lines of longitude going for the North Pole never meet the lines of longitude in the South Pole, and they're of an infinite length at the equator. So the equipotential lines of longitude are an infinite length. They've been stretched into an infinite length and would therefore have infinite stress being placed on them. And at this point, we toss in a brick because it can't spin any faster. And what would any sort of sane person do? Take a brick and throw it in it and see what happens, because we're now going to add angular momentum to a black hole that cannot have any more angular momentum.
Thanks for listening, everybody. If you liked what you heard, you may subscribe in your podcast provider and perhaps share in various social media sites. Bruce has promised he won't change the links anymore and screw up trying to find the next episode. Please enjoy the rest of your day and may everything work out for the best. We try to have a new podcast every Saturday, so see you next week.
The podcast you just heard was published with Anchor. Got something you want to say to the creator of this show? Send them a voice message using the Anchor app, free for iOS and Android.